It's now time to think outside the box of what we've always known.
I myself will tend my sheep and have them lie down, declares the sovereign Lord.
I think that's a profound turning point in somebody's relationship with God.
And our hope in starting this was that this would become an ever-expanding conversation.
Just two real guys talking about life. That's a nice tagline.
I'm Wayne Jacobson.
And I'm Brad Cummings.
And welcome to another edition of The God Journey.
You're back from Raleigh.
Barely.
I know. Dude, you're getting time zone challenge or something like that.
No, it wasn't that.
No?
Raleigh's a strange place to go.
Uh-oh.
And it's a strange place to come back
from. Careful, we probably have listeners there.
Yeah, we're going to have a few. Everybody always listens now when I'm somewhere. Like, okay, what's he going to say about it?
Yeah. Well, we've heard it's strange.
But it was hard getting back. I mean, the plane lands in Los Angeles, and then we taxi to the far end of the runways and park ourselves because we don't have a gate to go to. And my thought is always, what?
Just let us off a few feet in front of the gate. I'll walk down the steps.
I just go, what, United Airlines didn't know they had a scheduled flight in from so-and-so at such and such a time. That just drives me insane.
Well, you know what? When they oversell the plane and they just sort of assume a handful of people aren't going to show up, part of me is going like, you know, if I got a flight, I'm going to be
Yeah, but actually people don't. That usually works. And then you can give free flights to people to wait a while. And I've done that a number of times to get a free flight. So that all works. But they don't give you nothing if they just park at their own and say, I'm sorry, ladies and gentlemen, we don't have a gate available. Like, what? This was a surprise flight? This is not a regularly scheduled. And you just sit there for half an hour. We sat at the end of the runway after arriving.
Yeah, but you can use your phone now. It's great.
Well, I can use my phone, but there's not much I use my phone for.
Oh, you have fun games on there. You just play games?
Well, not the games, but the other stuff. All the phone messages I don't want to have to deal with and all of that stuff. But anyway, Raleigh is just a wear out, man. I come away from...
A wear... Raleigh is just a wear out. Okay.
Well, I just come...
I bet they feel affirmed. How you doing, Raleigh?
Well, it's not the people. There's great people there. It's, for whatever reason...
The city itself wears you out?
No, it's the people. But
okay.
I'm trying to be nice. Stop it. I'm trying to be nice about this.
That's right. All right. Go ahead.
Well, they don't ever get together. So I bounce around. Rather than when I normally go somewhere, I hang out for the weekend with a group of people.
They get together.
We get to know each other. They get to know each other. And at the end of it, people, it's just wonderful. I've been twice to Raleigh, and both times it's a series of scheduled events in different places with different groups of people.
Yeah, not your favorite. I get that.
But I feel more like the speaker guy than I feel like, boy, we just sat down and we're family. And I don't know what the deal is there. I mean, it's all good stuff, but I mean, it's Saturday morning into early afternoon with a wonderful discussion about living loved and how we help people live loved. And that was a great discussion. And then all those folks go home. I go to a different home. And from...
Start it all over again.
3 o'clock on, I've got a whole fresh group of people. See, if it's the same people all day long, they wear out when I wear out. But if it's not, they're all high energy, let's go. And I can fit into that with them.
Right.
But then I go back to the house I'm staying at, and it's... Boy. And I honestly, there's only one other time when I flew back from South Africa. I was so wasted, tired-wise. I just couldn't read on the plane. I couldn't maintain thought in a movie. You just kind of sit there feeling worthless. And that's how it was yesterday, flying home, going, I'm reading words on pages, but they mean nothing. The words
are just,
yeah. So I hate being that tired, but I know part of it is I leave tired these days. There's so much going on here that by the time I get on a plane, I'm already tired. And then hanging out for folks the weekend. But I get the next couple of weeks.
Well, at least you're not here at home. You might be sick of being tired, but at least you're not sick and tired.
No, I'm not sick and tired. And I say, gosh, great time. Met some wonderful people. And then Sunday, we ended up about 6 hours with probably, you know, 65 or so folks. And they came from all over. Some drove down from Virginia, some over from South Carolina. And it was just some wonderful Q&A and some tender moments of people opening their hearts at really difficult points of their journey. And people came away just saying, man, that is an incredible dialogue. But again, I end up going from that to another group of people.
Right. any common threads you see emerging from your travels? Not just Raleigh, but just kind of all over?
Well, the two big things are learning to live loved, which we talked a little bit on the last pod. If you don't see it, if you don't get it, you know, how do you find that niche?
Right.
And the other part of it is, what do we do about body life? And, the hardest thing, I think, is the phrase, it's repeated over and over again, we've got to do something.
You know what?
It's not funny.
That phrase, I think, has probably created a whole bunch of golden calves over we got to do something.
No, it does. It's Peter at the Transfiguration. Got to build a building. Got to build a shelter. Got to build a shrine.
Yeah, we should do something.
And I think people feel that. People who've been, you know, their whole journey in Christianity has been doing stuff.
But, yeah, so much of that is a need to validate why we're getting together and what we are doing.
Part of it's that, and part of it is, I'm just sitting around. Got to do something. And so they generally start house churches or start Bible studies, and the first kind of weeks they're not too bad, and then somewhere down the road it's just people trying to do something, and that'll eventually get to be fruitless or futile or however we want to say it.
Yeah, futile.
Futile. But then people struggle with, well, then what do we do next? And there's this drive, and what I want to say to people is, you know, God's called us to enter into his rest, the Hebrews 3:14-3:4, where we cease from our own labors. And then people say, well, we just sit around and do nothing. Believe me.
That's not what rest means.
When you sort out how loved you are and you start crawling in that space with God opening
There's
up
no
things
absence
in your life, you'll work harder
ingenuity.
Than yeah, you work harder than you've ever worked. So Paul says, I labor and strive more than any man. Here's the guy who's talking about
rest.
Ceasing from your own labors and not having confidence in your own flesh and your own abilities. But I think that phrase of we gotta do something is really that which transfers us from, I don't hear Jesus asking me to do anything, but human effort says I've gotta do something or I'm worthless, so I get in it.
That transfers you from a relationship right back into religion.
It does.
Without knowing it.
It's the arm of
well-intentioned.
That's what people miss that. You know, religion is not built on our worst intentions. It's actually built on our best intentions. But it substitutes God's work. I mean, substitutes our work for God's.
Right.
And that's where it gets boring and people wear out.
It's giving your Cain offering. It's like you're working really hard and it's like you sort of assumed, well, God would want me to do this. And when he's going like, that isn't what I wanted you to do. He's just being real. I didn't want you to do that. I didn't ask for that. But I made it for you. And then it's like you got to force a gift on somebody, and then you're offended that that's not what they wanted.
And he's usually very gracious and say, you know, I appreciate it. And I realize you wore yourself out doing this, and I appreciate the fact that you love me enough to try and do all that. But the reality is, it's futile. It's just you trying to do, and God's inviting us into a space where he does. And we live alongside him. And I think the scariest thing for people who go on this journey, who haven't sorted out a church experience yet, I don't know people to walk with, I don't know how to walk with them, but we've got to do something.
Why do you think that question pops up in the naked soul? Why are we so susceptible to that? Because I think that is the biggest challenge. It's like when God invites you to say, hey, sit still, let me come to you. For most of us, that takes too long. Nothing tangible that I can grab onto is happening. And all of a sudden that produces an anxiety. And like sitting here today, being a different person than I was, I go, I don't get why that's so challenging. Why don't you just sit there? I do remember back when that was terrifying.
I think the flesh just loves to do something. I think that's... The flesh is just going, give me.
Let's just do something.
And I think there's something about feeling like I'm in control. The scariness of getting through this detox period of living to your own
ends.
Ability. Not even your own ends. It's your own abilities to God's end even. And that's where religion often goes. It's human effort. It's Paul, Philippians 3.
That's a subtle one.
I love the power of Philippians 3 where Paul's saying, if I had confidence in the flesh before, and I did, and more reason far more than anybody, now I have zero confidence in the flesh. I don't think there's anything I can do to produce the work of God. And to me, that is a great gift of freedom, But it's a long time for the flesh to come to that reality, because it feels then, okay, I'm not doing anything. I'm not in control of this. And living inside the love of the Father means, yeah, you're right. You don't control this. As a pastor, I had this conversation in Raleigh. That was hilarious. As a pastor, we were sitting around figuring out, how do we get this gospel in the world? Because we could read the New Testament and see Jesus didn't start a meeting and ask people to come to it. He didn't.
I know.
He worked.
How do we get to where we're at now?
Well, 90% of his stuff was he just moved through life. So there's a woman at a well, and there's a woman caught in adultery, and there's this greedy guy in a tree, and there's this blind Bartimaeus by the road. He was moving through life, and we were trying to figure out how to do that. So
how to just move through life?
There were three or four of us. Yeah, how we're going to take Jesus to the real place.
Oh, as a pastor guy, you're doing this.
Not even, yeah, it was back in the day, but not even as a pastor guy, just as a, so we used to get together and pray, four or five of us. And then we go down to the mall and kind of wander around the mall looking for a real opportunity to do a Jesus thing. As well intentioned
looking
as...
Looking for a victim.
Well, we're praying.
We're going to do Jesus on.
Well, we're going to... We're stalking people, trying to figure out that. You know, we pray and, you know...
I'm going to show God loved you in a practical way.
I look back at what we did. And many days we went to the mall and we come back going, nothing. Or whatever we did seems so
contrived
and artificial that we just
I think that's one of the biggest challenges, is that I think because we're not focused on the dialogue of just, hey, you know what? Maybe God doesn't have some big old mission mountain for me to climb, and maybe there's just relationship that I can enjoy. Because that seems way too simple.
That's the fear. Of the flesh, right there.
Right. We invent something that is my pathway to significance or some form of validation that can go like, well, that's worthy.
Right.
And so we embark on that well-intentioned journey, but perhaps without guidance or the direction for it from Him. So we're kind of on our own, well-intentioned. And in the midst of that, I think there's the subtle expectations that because it involves work that I think I'm doing for Him, there's that sense of, well, I want to get rewarded. And when it doesn't pan out like we supposed, it does set you up for being a little miffed.
Yeah, either at God, because He doesn't go through, or if you're the ministry organizer, you get miffed at
the
people
who
didn't do
it. Not doing it right, and they're not committed, and all that other
stuff. If you guys had prayed more, or worked harder, or more people would have come, this would have been a better event than it was. And doesn't that all begin with, I'm not living with enough security inside the relationship I have, so the anxiousness of, well, I don't know that He's asking me to do anything, and I don't see Him engaging me with people in my life. So I do, and that's what I hear from a lot of people. I wasn't having any fellowship at all, so we started a meeting, which didn't become fellowship at all. Rather than...
No, it's an obligation.
Rather than what Sarah
Lightless
and I do...
Lightless obligation.
Yeah, rather than what Sarah and I do, almost every week we sit down and say, who does God want us to be with this week? We had that conversation last night. I'm tired and sitting home. So who's on your heart for us to connect with this week? Anybody? And if it's nobody, we don't mind having a week where we just enjoy each other. Yes. So, but we always are asking the question, and we're thinking through the people we know, and we're saying, God. And so fellowship becomes intentional, not because Sarah and I feel like we have to do something. We don't. It's more, Father, are there people we can be a blessing to this week? And pursue fellowship there is a great way to begin, rather than, we're not having any. So we had to start a Friday night Bible group so we could get together and have fellowship.
Would it be correct to say that when you're focused on that kind of intentional relationship, that your goal is not so much to do something to somebody as to get to know someone?
Yeah.
See, I think that changes the dynamics massively.
Yeah,
when was the last time someone sat down? I mean, I don't know, maybe this happens to you a bunch, but I don't think this happens to many people. When was the last time someone sat down with an absolute interest and understanding you? Not to get something from you, but just to understand you. That happen often?
Yeah, I would. Yeah, I think.
Well, I mean, I think there's a reason some people will see.
Because they know you're going through stuff, yeah. But I think you're right, because I think fellowship begins by there's people in my life I begin to care about.
Yes.
We think ministry, or we think fellowship begins by there's a gift I have and I have to find victims to receive it. some of it.
Can I do my Jesus on you?
And I
go, please don't.
And what people are honestly going through when there's all that vacuum in your life and you feel like, gosh, there's nothing going on. And I think it's God inviting us to do what he did with Paul, is I want you to lose your confidence in the flesh. And just about the time we're going to lose it, we give into it, do something, get in the middle of it and go, say, I wish I hadn't done this, but here I am. And God just keeps inviting us in. I want you to lose the need for that. I want you to lose the need for fellowship. I want you to lose the need to connect so that when you do connect, it's not so self-based. It's
right.
I'm fully relaxed in my engagement with God and what he asked me to do about in the world. Now I can look around and say, God, who are you asking me to care about? Who are you asking me to care for? So I can sit down and have that conversation with them. Because the question isn't really how many people sit down and ask me and really care about me, but how many people am I involved with that just being with them is about getting to know them and caring about them?
I think people feel incredibly loved when someone is genuinely interested, not as, hi, this is my little relational tool to get somewhere in Jesus. It's when someone's just genuinely interested in them. And you can do that in a couple minutes. You can do that in the way you greet someone. You can do that for the coffee barista person who is no longer just a function but an actual person behind there.
Yeah.
Just those tangible little moments when someone just says, you know, I'm going to love you for you, not for what I get out of it. But I'm going to show interest in you because my assumption is there's something wonderful there to be discovered. That becomes a total different day when you approach it that way. And there's life there. There's no effort to try. And I haven't found many days like that that people don't massively respond.
Pretty much.
Because I don't think they get that. Much at all.
Unless they're flying in first class.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I noticed this yesterday. I'm flying home first class, and as tired as I am and not wanting to read, I even enjoy talking to people. But I've been 1K United flyer this year because of all the miles I did last year. So almost every time I go to an airport, I'm bumped up to first class. And this whole trip, same thing. I get free first class tickets. But I don't like sitting with the people in first class. They don't want to talk. They're creepy people. Well, I don't mean they're creepy people.
You've dissed an entire cabin of class of people.
Well, they're mostly business people, and they've got a lot on their mind, and you're sitting next to them is kind of like an inconvenience that you're there. And I always turn and say, hey, hi, how you doing? Where are you going? And you can tell in 2 seconds
whether that's going to go anywhere or not.
I don't want to talk to you. Just leave me alone. I got stuff to do. I'm not sitting in first class with you if you're going to be a yacker. And so I just go, okay, I got other stuff to do, but I'm getting tired of flying first class. I'm going, okay, you get back in the cabin where the real people fly.
Yeah, walk back to us little people. You know, I think it's fascinating that Paul, having been the top of his game as a Pharisee, would actually have an encounter where he gets confronted by God, their God, who takes on a persona of what he thought was the enemy. And he says, Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me? And his response is, oh. I mean, in that moment to be able to go, Lord, he knew who it was. It wasn't like, well, who are you?
Yeah, he did say, who are you, Lord? He knew it was the Lord.
No,
he knew
no.
He was. And I bet by then, if you're killing Jesus people, you're sure hoping it's Buddha.
Yeah.
That's what I'm thinking.
No, I know, but in that exchange, I think he is having one of those revelatory moments that is profoundly helpful in life, but I think we're terrified of. He recognized my human zeal, my passion, my effort, all my energy has been expended in a direction that I'm now recognizing for the first time is wrong. And what do I do now?
Kind of a major wrong. I mean,
yeah,
you killed a few people.
It's a line crosser. It really is.
Yeah, really. And it's more, this is not hurt me more than it's hurt you. You've been hurting people.
But
seriously.
You know, when you talked about Paul having that season where it's like, how does he get weaned from the confidence he's placed in his flesh? and God wanting that season of time. A major encounter like that is a great trailhead for that journey. Without that, I don't think we're really confronted with the fact that, gosh, well intention is not necessarily the same thing as guided by the Holy Spirit.
Yeah, and hard work isn't necessarily godly work.
Right. Wow. You just, a whole bunch of Puritans, I just felt an earthquake on the East Coast. They just rolled over in their graves.
Even if you're not doing bad to people, you can do hard work trying to do good for people.
Right.
And hard work isn't necessarily God's work. And I don't.
Nope.
That's that dilemma. Paul, I don't think, lost all his flesh and his confidence in it one moment on a road.
That wasn't his full-on pharisectomy?
We've got a 3-year deal and then a 14-year deal.
And where a 13-year silence deal.
He's out of the limelight. He's in the wilderness somewhere. I mean, we've got God working this brother through a sense of only thing that matters is what's flowing out of me, not what you can do for me. And when Paul says that, I think that's the biggest freedom to win in this journey. I've talked about the tyranny of self, winning from the tyranny of self. That's huge. But one from that confidence that my ability for God is a good thing.
Right.
And come underneath his reality. Since the prayer in Colossians I love from Paul, which is, I pray that you'll know, this is that the eyes of your heart and be enlightened so that you will understand the ways in which God works. Mm-hmm. Then you can work alongside him in his vineyard. Until you know how God works, it's just human effort that, well-intentioned though it be, is going to be destructive to you and destructive to the very people you're trying to help, unfortunately.
Yeah. And I think what I find fascinating about the life of Jesus is perhaps different than Paul. He's not trying to wean Jesus from his confidence in self. Jesus doesn't do much for 30-some years, but live normal life. Grow up, be a son in a family, work alongside Joseph for a season. I mean, he celebrated the ordinariness of life and embraced that and didn't seem to have this whole impulse of, I got to do something. And even when other people were pushing him, he'd go like, my time has not yet come. Somehow, he had, out of his own well of relating with his father, he had a sense of when and when not to do what was in front of him.
Yeah.
And I think that, to me, that the beauty of looking at that life is, you know what? There's no need to validate it. There's no pressure of, we got to do something. And it's like,
he never demonstrated that. And I think it'd be great if those words, got to do something, would be a flashpoint in our brain saying, ooh,
danger, danger. If I go here,
I know where that's coming from. I'm not going there. I would rather do nothing and learn to live inside God's love than got to do something simply because I'm afraid I won't find fellowship, I won't be useful to God. Whatever fear the got to do something is addressing, if we could recognize that and recognize that then as an invitation to say, okay, God, I don't see what you're doing in my life, so I'm trying to do something. Because if Jesus could wake up, I only do the things I see the Father doing. I only say the things I hear the Father saying, which means if I don't hear him saying anything and I don't see him doing anything, I have no compulsion to go do something anyway.
Right.
That's a great freedom.
I think that takes a tremendous amount of courage.
And it may take 14 years in the wilderness to figure that out. People are in such a hurry. And I've been on this journey 6 months. Think I'd get this by now? I'm going, no, I don't think you would by now. I'm still trying to live inside that. I've been on this journey.
Scale back your expectations.
Yeah, 15 years of learning to live loved, and I'll still have those got to do something moments creep up. And I've just looked better at now going, ew, yuck, rather than, yeah, got to do it. And so when I hear other people say it now, there's something in me going, ew, yuck. And so I get to say, ew, yuck, don't. Why are you doing this? We got to do something. No, you don't. Really, you don't have to do anything. Learn to live inside the work of the Father. You've been called to rest. You've been called to the unforced rhythms of grace. You've been called to live a different way than being driven by your flesh's need to be active.
I don't think we've defined rest very well. I think because most people, when they hear you got to rest, all they think of is
a couch and a remote.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's like it's a do nothing response, and it's like I don't think that's what rest is about at all.
No.
I got somebody that is, I don't know when this will ever come out, as far as I don't know when it's going to be done, but I got somebody who's working on, I think, a beautiful revelation of what this is about that has just floored me. I'm just going, yeah, that's it. And I'm going to tease people purposely to go, I'm not telling you yet. But they've seen it from a whole different standpoint that I'm just going like, that has nothing to do with not doing something. That has everything to do with where do I find my satisfaction.
Mm-hmm.
That place of rest is a place of contentment. It's a place of where am I drawing life from? Where's that? Is it the fruit of my labors? Am I trying to make it happen? Do I need to validate something? Am I afraid of my inactivity and therefore I'm worthless? I mean, we get so much of who we are and our sense of value through some kind of achievement of something.
Yep.
And if I can't point to something, nobody goes, woohoo, I feel great. Most everyone is going, I feel worthless. And he's going, why are you on that road? As if that one is the correctly defined value indicator. Because I think that is really one of the big roots of religion, is that I somehow want to find a way to validate and justify whatever it is that I don't feel so great about.
And often, isn't it because we're looking at someone else and what they're doing, and
sure,
and we value them.
The comparative value system.
So then we feel, yep, undervalued because we don't have to do something that looks like that.
My gift is not like that.
The whole John 14, 15, 16 deal, Jesus keeps saying, I'm telling you these things so that my joy would be in you and that your joy would be full. And I think what he's saying is you're most effective in the world when you're settled inside his joy, not when you're unsettled and therefore trying to
get it,
find a way to make it happen. And that settledness, that finding our way into the reality of that affection, which is what we talked about in the last podcast, that's stirred up a hornet's nest of activity.
I'm not going to interrupt you, and I'm not going to be passionate.
I've watched you choke down a few interruptions today. I'm going, wow.
I know. I'm really good. I'm tired of getting dinged for it.
People are dinging you. Yeah. But they're dinging me, too. They're just going. And, you know, I thought it was interesting. I was watching this while I'm in Raleigh. I'm watching it roll through on my iPhone when there's a new posting on the blog. And I'm going, oh, my gosh. Why are people choosing sides? This is funny.
We're in a fight, buddy.
When you and I aren't choosing sides. We didn't. I like the one email where someone talked about, I like you guys doing that because that's both sides of me. Me fighting this, then there's a me fighting this. And I'll go, that's really good, because I think that's true for all of us. We have this, you know, innate sense of, well, it's this, but it's also this, and I don't know which way to land. And but boy, I thought, why are people choosing sides? We had a great dialogue, I thought. We weren't on the same page, but welcome to the world.
I didn't like the way you edited it. I just go, well, that's not what I was thinking.
I didn't edit anything.
No, the way you ended it. It just was right there. Let's not be frustrated.
Well, there wasn't anything after that that was valuable. I was going, that's where it ended.
Like, oh, man. So.
Yeah. Well, we had a little reaction I thought was kind of interesting. This from a guy named Mikhail, I don't know how to pronounce that, on the blog. Brad and Wayne, first of all, you guys are really nice guys. It seems like you have raised wonderful families.
How would he know?
That being said, you guys kind of irritate me. Over the last year, I've become a dogmatic agnostic. That's really
okay.
A dogmatic agnostic.
I don't know what that is.
There may be a God, but there's no way to know for sure. I no longer believe in the God of the Bible, so as far as the Bible goes, I'm an atheist, versus Brad and Wayne. The God you guys talk about is a lovely, touchy-feeling, sweetheart God, which I would say, no, that's not the God I'm talking about, but anyway, which is definitely not the God of the Bible, and I agree. The God of the Bible hates sinners and is eager to fry them in hell for eternity.
Okay.
Now, I would take exceptions.
Hey, Lord, what do you want for lunch? Give me some fried sinners, baby.
My question for you is this. Feel free to believe in whatever God you want to believe in, but why do you claim that your view of God is in line with what the Bible says about God, Brad and Wayne? I like your God better than the Bible God.
Nah.
I just think you're wrong for implying that your God is the God of the Bible.
Well, God bless his opinion. I would really disagree with a fair amount of that.
I want to vehemently disagree, except that I'm a sweetheart, touchy-feely kind of guy.
Vehemently. I've never heard it quite syllabled like that.
Well, he's trusting people's distortions of the God of the Bible. Can you quote scripture from the Bible that leads you to believe God is this guy? I think you can take things out of context and do that.
But, you can twist anything any which way you want to according to the lens you're looking through. I think the real challenge is...
And many have in our day.
Yes.
I agree that what he's saying many people teach.
Yeah. I just think one of the biggest challenges out there is to really, honestly, and I don't think it's possible for human beings to be very objective. I really don't. I think all of us are very subjective. We look through the lens of our experience, the lens of our history, what's been
all that stuff. I have to live inside of here. How can I not be?
Yeah, I mean, just going, it's like, if you can acknowledge that, then we can go like, you know, chances are I really need to have this balanced by other views, other opinions, and then I need to kind of wrestle with all that. I think we need to learn to relate to the God who is. If you find things in the Old Testament that are like really awful mind-benders, where you're like, God, you're just terrible. Well, you might want to turn that into a conversation as opposed to an accusation and just go like, I don't know how to see you like others want to present. Like, I mean, the warm, fuzzy God. See, I go like, you know what? I don't think there's a warm, fuzzy God and the guy that woke up with a headache and had a bad day. It's like, I think there's the God who is, and then we need to learn to understand who that is. And in those situations, what's going on? I don't know that if I don't understand the context. I mean, if all of a sudden you got that time capsule that you know, unbury, you know, remember like in the 70s, everyone was burying time capsules? I remember when I was in school, it was like, ooh, we buried a time capsule. And I'm sitting there like, okay, here we are, 2010. Well, dig that thing up. Just because we see a few things in there, are we going to know what's going on? No, and until we get a little bit of a perspective and a context, I think we can greatly distort and misinterpret what's happening there.
Yeah, and obviously Mikhail feels like the Bible, God is the agent of destruction in the Scriptures.
Right.
And we've talked about this before. I think God is the agent of rescue. I think Jesus, you couldn't put those words about God, neither the touchy-feely sweetheart God, you couldn't put that on Jesus. And you couldn't, on the other hand, say Jesus is just loving to fry sinners. You couldn't put that on him, either one of those two. So he creates this kind of false dichotomy here, right, and says you got to be in one or the other. And I'm sorry, I'm in neither of those. I think God is both love and light. And I think light is painful at times, but when it's carried inside God's love, it's a great thing. And God is the rescuer in this story. He's not the one looking to throw people into hell. He's standing on the brink, dragging people out. That's his passion.
Yeah, and I think when Hebrews speaks of Jesus as he is the exact representation, like, you're not going to get a better picture in the flesh of who God is. So when people have this sort of good cop, bad cop, oh, I love Jesus, but God the Father, I don't know about him, I end up going like, please deal with Hebrews, what it's saying right there. There isn't a good cop, bad cop dichotomy here.
No.
You can't interpret the Old Testament as, well, that's just God with an attitude, and then thank goodness Jesus comes along because God, somewhere between Malachi and Matthew, gets saved and gets kind and friendly.
He grew up. He became a nice guy. Crazy.
But I think the challenge is, how do we read Scripture and not do it through our sort of arcane religious lens that may well be in reaction or whatever to all the junk that has been said. It's not like you can just push delete or reset, like, oh, I never got shaped that way. It's like, well, no, quite a bit of our thoughts of God have been shaped by some of that stuff. And so our interpretations as we read this can get quite askew.
And Deb wrote this, and sorry, Deb, I like most of what you tried to say. I think this bit of it, I went, ooh, ouch. I think God takes sin personally. If he's any kind of personal being, I do hope he takes sin personally. It offends him deeply. And then she goes on to the glory of the cross, what he's done for us, freeing from sin's grip. I don't know that God, that my sin offends God deeply. I learned that growing up. I did. He deeply offended by my sin. But I look at the world now and the things I'm going through, my granddaughters and sin in their life. I hurt with their sin because I know it hurts them. Their sin does not offend me deeply. I don't have this big hurt in my heart because you're sinning. And I'm not sure that's what Deb means. That is what she wrote. And I think if we get into that, that God's deeply offended by sin, so he had to nail his son on a cross and take all that offense out, I think we're missing who God is. I don't think our sin offends him. I think it disappoints him. I think he hurts for us in our sin. That's all very different than my sin offends him deeply.
And I do think that sin affects my capacity to relate to him well, not from his side, but from my side. I don't think my sin precludes God from relating to me because it's like, excuse me, anyone look at planet Earth? God's not absent, but it's kind of full of sin. And the whole idea is, oh, God can't look upon my sin. It's like, well, then where in the world could he look?
Yeah.
You know, I think he can, and I don't think he's there. Oh, I'm offended.
Yeah.
I think I've always been taught that from a relational context of, oh, you wouldn't want to hurt God's heart. And I don't. I do want a friendship with him. I don't want to affect him. But I don't think he's like us in that way in terms of out of our insecurity. Well, you offended me, so I'm going to turn my back.
And one way to gauge that for me on this journey is I find the more I learn to live inside of God's love, I am less offended internally by the wrong people do, even the wrong people do against me. I'm less offended. I wish you weren't doing that. I wish you could just grow up and be a man and not be such a wuss. And I wish you wouldn't be mean and lie about me. I can wish all that and inside and I go, oh, deeply offended. And I've got to. I used to be. I'm not. And when she says we were still sinners, enemies of God, which scripture says we were enemies of God, it doesn't say we were God's enemies. There's a difference. That's that sin thing. Yeah, I feel estranged from him. And then she said this, which I love. I pray one day we can see this. It blows me away how much I am loved by someone who so hates my disease. I like the way she says that.
I like that.
Yeah, hates it enough to lay his own life down to heal me from it, lays down his life to reconcile me to God. And I think the laying down didn't satisfy the offense in God. It satisfied the bondage in us and opened a great door.
I think we have this tendency to want to make God in our image as opposed to how does he fashion and refashion my life into his. I think that's one of the things I get a little tweaked about is I think I've recognized, you know what? I don't want to come at God with my judgments and evaluation of him. I have.
Sure.
I just have never felt like that proved to be very fruitful. Maybe it was on my road learning to be honest and not just pretending. But at some point, you got to say, you know what? I'm going to take it at face value that you're God and I'm not. And therefore, if one of us is going to have a more likely true perception of this, he is, not me. So, Lord, help me see this as you do. There's things that go on just going like, I don't understand why you allow things like that. That really bothers me. It bothers me when stuff happens in my life that I just go like, that's not fair. And I don't like it when I see things happen in the world. And you're just like, huh. And it's like, as opposed to, well, forget you, God, you don't care. You know, my kids, when they were little, would have reactions like that and statements towards me that were from their vantage point. And I, as a parent, go like, okay, I don't really enjoy you thinking that. That's not helping our relationship. But I wasn't sitting there like, oh, I'm going to get you. That's wrong. You just go like, you love someone through to a different conclusion.
Yeah.
And I think that's where God's at with our attitudes. It's like, you know what? I don't think we see him clearly. I think we name a lot of things that are going on as if they're him. But I don't think they are at all.
Yeah, and I think religion does that, and our guilt and all that stuff. It always, whenever we're doing something wrong, I think I'm seeing this more clearly every day. The more I want to live in the darkness, I have to make enemies of people who aren't. I have to point my finger and make corrupt people who aren't necessarily doing anything wrong, but to justify my darkness, I have to tear you apart.
Yeah.
I got this is from John. It was on the blog, actually. And I changed the name just because it was on the blog. So I guess the name's Gabriel. Let's go with that. He says, "Hi, Wayne. Feels like I know you after listening to Transition 5 times. Now listening to you talk with Brad on the God Journey. In 2008, life turned on me. That's how it felt. And my world came to a standstill after a few things happened to me. Lost my job in January at the age of 59. Ooh. Disappointments and disillusion in church life. Resigned as an elder. Sinned and was expelled from my pigeon passion, from my pigeon racing, which was his passion. He got banned for 5 years for cheating.
Steroid use in pigeons?
I don't know. That's interesting. My beloved dog died after I prayed and trusted God for her. My wife sued me for a divorce out of the blue. Lost my house, had to leave town to try and start over. God got caught up in a fleshy relationship with an unbeliever. Bad experience. No kidding. Was kidnapped and threatened with death.
No.
Very scary. This guy's been... He said, in all this, I was aware of Father's love, but the guilt and shame consumed me. I could not get over my brokenness. I thought I was a healed man, but now my own doctrine and religion condemned me. Now I have the wonderful assurance that Papa loves me, and I'm enjoying the journey day by day as he works in me. What a freedom." That's quite
what a journey.
That's a story. That's one of the stories you read and go, wow, my story wasn't so hard. It wasn't this brutal. Bless your heart, brother. I'm glad you found some greater freedom to live in that love. But I think what he's saying that I think dovetailed on what you just said is when you live by all this religious angst, then when things get worse for you, God's not the refuge to fall into. He's the pointed finger in our imagination. You deserve this. You're getting what you deserve. And the condemnation that religion puts on people who are at depths of struggle, and this came up a lot this weekend when I was in Raleigh, the problem with religion is when you need God most, you are the most estranged from him. Because you've earned it. Whatever crap's going on, whatever garbage is going on in your life.
You cages.
I'm sorry. Doggone it. Whatever garbage is going on in your life, now God's on the other side of that instead of in it with you. Even if it's caused by your own silliness, your own cheating, your own whatever, God's still inside now to redeem me to himself out of what's causing me to do these things that are hurtful in my life.
You know, it talks in Romans, you know, that, you know, nothing can separate us from the love of God. It, you know, lists off a whole litany of stuff just going like, oh, that's a pretty good list of separators.
Yeah.
And they're basically saying nothing. It's like from God's side, you can't lose him. We can get lost in our perception, but he's not going to abandon us. And I think when you allow some of those things to seep in, and if you can't receive them as true, maybe just being open to the possibility that they might be true, I just think it shifts your capacity to look at life and what's going on and allow you to draw a whole different set of conclusions than the ones we do in our reactions.
Yeah, and we start out by talking about this arm of flesh, this got to do something. And then we end by talking about this same problem that goes on mentally, which is I've got to justify God out of my own flesh, or I've got to figure out who he is out of my own flesh, which is going to lead you just as wrong the other way.
Well, yeah, if you've got to play both sides of the conversation, there's no relationship in that. That's just you trying to talk yourself into some corner.
And it still comes back to how do we relax into a relationship with God, our Abba, who then straightens up our view of him and allows us to live differently in the world, not motivated by all that fleshy stuff.
Tangibly, just as opposed to just leaving someone on that cliff of, well, okay, that's what it is. How long did it take when you all of a sudden understood that maybe God could talk and maybe he did speak and it wasn't just in the verses of Scripture and you tried to have that relationship? Where'd you go with that? What'd you do? How long did that take to all of a sudden become aware of something that was more than just Wayne Jacobson talking to Wayne Jacobson inside his head?
Really, 43 minutes into the podcast and you want to go there. This is another 25-minute podcast. For me, he spoke first. I didn't formulate the theology and go looking for a voice.
Okay.
He spoke. And it was a matter of, who is that? Is that me? Is that someone else? And finding that, you know, it wasn't compatible with me.
Yeah. It asked me to do something I didn't particularly want to do.
That took me to a whole different world. And, yeah. But I...
When you wait for him, And yeah, this could be another 20 conversations.
2 hours.
But when you wait for him, how do you do that?
I don't know that I wait for him. I mean, there's times I spend with him, but mostly the things that God drops in my head and heart these days come when I'm not even consciously thinking about
his initiative
and praying. Yeah, just I'm driving somewhere, I'm sitting on an airplane seat, and something drops in your head, and you go, whoa, where did that come from? That's interesting.
Ever been in a situation where you needed to hear from him on a certain subject that he wasn't initiating conversation on, and you were like trying to find it? Cause I think
you know how many people have missed their train stops and bus stops?
I don't care. That this is a good one to miss it for. I think there's a bunch of people out there that, at least from the fodder that came out of the last one, there's people that they're looking to connect with God. That's a sincere pursuit and passion.
Right.
And I'm wanting to just, how do you dial down and not make that so anxiety-filled so that the you got to do something screams at them?
That's why you talk about you relaxing into this reality. If this isn't a reality for you, you're tenseness trying to make it happen is not helping. Got to find a way, and I think it begins with him. You've got to start by saying, God, I want to relax in this. Would you show me how you're already communicating with me? Because I don't think it's he's not. I think in all
it.
The other stuff going on in my head, it's blowing by me.
Okay.
I think God engages us all. And we can talk about that as we have. There's past podcasts that talk about it. There's one about dancing into that relationship.
That's good. That was worth missing your stop for.
Well, I missed mine.
Thank you for traveling with us on the God Journey. You can be part of the conversation by visiting our website, thegodjourney.com.